Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So let me try it now. I've got Ray here. No. No, Ray. No.
It's the Ray bit that gets me. No, Ray. You've been a very naughty, but you're only a bit far away from that.
This week on Walking the Dog, I chatted to a man who's been called the best dog trainer in Britain. He's even known as the Dog Father. Yes, Ray, he will make you an offer you can't refuse. My guest is the presenter of TV's Dogs Behaving Very Badly, Graham Hall. There is literally no dog problem this man cannot solve. So I was dying to find out more about him, and yes, okay, shamelessly pick his brains about some of Ray's less than appealing habits. Graham told me all about his childhood in Yorkshire, where he grew up dogless, and why he suddenly decided to change his life at 40 to become a dog trainer. We chatted about how his job is actually much more about people than dogs, and he's got some fascinating insights into human behaviour. He also told me about his sadness after losing his Rottweilers Axel and Gordon, and how Lily the Labrador Boxer came into his life more recently. If you've ever seen Graham on Channel 5's Dogs Behaving Very Badly, you'll know that he's got a very calm, down-to-earth manner with dogs, but he's also like that with people. And after chatting with him, I genuinely felt like I'd had a little bit of therapy. He's just published a book called All Dogs Great and Small, which is a really funny and fascinating read. And I also recommend his podcast, Talking Dogs with Graham Hall. And if you haven't seen Dogs Behaving Very Badly on Channel 5, then do. It's genius. I totally adored Graham. He's just a lovely bloke. In fact, I'd even go so far as to call him a good boy. And you are too, Ray. The ego of this dog. I'll hand over to the man himself now. I really hope you enjoy our chat. Here's Graham. Good boy, Graham. Good boy.
Yes. There you go. Hey, careful with the voice. Don't be too excited. I might get hyper. I'll be running around the room and then you'll never stop me.
I'm very excited because with me on Walking the Dog this week is Graham Hall, the UK's best dog trainer. That was official, by the way. He was actually called that. And presenter of Dogs Behaving Very Badly. We've kicked off already because that's what you do. I've seen you go to people's houses and you just get stuck right in. You're a Yorkshireman, you roll your sleeves up. No fancy standing on ceremony for Graham Hall. Whilst you're here, I'm sure you get this a lot, my dog is sitting next to me, my dog Raymond, and he's giving me what can only be described as evils. He gives me these dirty looks. Why does my dog give me dirty looks when I'm doing something?
And there's nothing like a shih tzu for those sort of looks, is there?
Yes.
That disparaging, like, what do you think you're doing?
What is it, Graham?
Well, for a start, they don't understand how microphones work, so correct me if I'm wrong, but you're sat there talking to yourself in front of a strange piece of apparatus, right? So Raymond, like any self-respecting dog, is looking at you going, have you lost it, mother? And the second part, of course, is, yeah, he's like, well, hello, you're meant to give me attention. What are you doing?
I wish I could be with you in person, but obviously we're responsible citizens and we're doing this remotely. And you're speaking to me from your home, which is...
Yeah, I live in the Cotswolds these days. So I'm famously a Yorkshireman, but I've lived... if I'm honest, I've probably lived outside of Yorkshire longer than I lived in. But I have the excuse that I have to live down south because I'm on missionary duty. So some of us have to spread the word of Yorkshireness.
So, Graham, I want to go back to the start of the dog father and where it all began, really, because you didn't have dogs when you were growing up, did you?
No, that's right. I mean, mum and dad were both working. And my dad in particular was very keen that, no, we're not going to have dogs. And one thing that he used to say all the time was, it's too difficult when they go. It's too hard when they go. And And I always assumed that he meant, you know, the end of life when they die. But actually, when I was writing the book, because the book's sort of part memoir, but I made a connection, which I'd never made before, which was there's a story that he told me of when he had a dog as a kid, and he lived in a pub in Selby in Yorkshire. It was called the Volunteers Arms. It's not there anymore, hasn't been for decades. But this was World War II. And for whatever reason, the dog got rehomed, and the reason's been lost in the mist of time, but it was taken away to a place called Garforth, which is a good 15 miles away on the edge of Leeds. And the dog found his way back again, right? Now, I always, as a kid, thought, yeah, right, that's a bit of a long story, but I've learned since that actually it's entirely possible that there's lots of cases where dogs have travelled much further than that. So for whatever reason, this dog came back, ended up on the doorstep of the pub. My dad was there. His dog had come home, and then, of course, you know, his dad, my granddad, said, no, the dog has to go, and took him away again, and that was that. And so when I was growing up, I grew up with this, we're not having dogs because it's too hard when they go. So that was that. Dogs weren't for us, really, and that was it. But I always kind of liked dogs, and every time I met one, somebody else's, there's a bit of an affinity there, let's just say.
I wanted to know a bit more about your childhood, actually. How would you describe it? If you could describe it in one word, I would describe my childhood, Graham, as bohemian chaos.
I read a bit about that. Is it true that you used to, for breakfast sometimes, you'd have canapés from the party the night before? Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, my upbringing was a bit different. It was, I suppose, a bit more, yeah, Yorkshire market town. I went to school in the big city, Leeds. But you and I have one point of commonality, which is I too used to have unusual breakfast sometimes, which in my case was jacket potatoes. And that's because my dad was an electrician at the sugar factory. My dad would be on night shift. So every now and again, they'd pull out a big potato that come in with the sugar beet. My dad had put the word out that if you get a couple of potatoes, bring them to me in the electrician's workshop, because he was going to heat them up in the oven all night. Me and my sister would have baked potatoes. So he'd cycle back about 3 miles from the factory first thing in the morning on a push bike with baked potatoes in a tinfoil packet in his little saddlebag. And that's what we had. I had no idea that it wasn't normal to have baked potatoes for breakfast, but there you go.
So it was you, your dad, and your sister, Andrea. And your mum was a teacher, is that right? A swimming teacher?
No, a swimming teacher. Yeah. That's where you got that from, yeah. So mum was a swimming teacher, that's right. And her mum before her. So they both worked at the local swimming bath. It's not there anymore. So we both knew how to swim, that's for sure.
What was your family experience like? Was it a noisy household? Was it disciplined household?
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? It's hard to judge. I think it was a fairly noisy household, but there was only two of us kids. I mean, myself and Andrea, we were like cat and dog as kids. I mean, we're really quite close now and text each other most days and all sorts of things. But back then, I mean, I don't know if you remember, there was a pop song by Brian and Michael, and they sang that song about matchstick men and matchstick cats and dogs, right? You've got to be of a certain age to remember this.
Yeah, sadly I am, because it was based on Lowry paintings, I believe.
Exactly that. That's the thing, right? So that was the thing. It was a one-hit wonder. And I was a couple of years older than Andrea, but she loved it. She thought it was great. So she, as teenage girls do, she'd drawn up like Brian and Michael, and it was all in her bedroom. And then she put, and they hit number one, I think. So she put, Brian and Michael are number one forever, right? So I kept taunting her, going, they won't be number one forever. They won't be number one ever again. You'll never hear from them ever again, as teenage boys do. As it turns out, more luck than judgment. Turns out I was right. So every now and again, and we're probably 40 years on now, I have to remind her that Brian and Michael aren't number one forever. So that's the kind of house we had. My mum trying to keep control of two warring children, and my dad, who was quite a quiet guy, really, just wanted an easy life. Yeah, he was trying to stay out of it, I think.
What was your role in the family? If you had to give yourself a moniker, like a Spice Girls moniker.
Yeah, I've never been asked that question. Which Spice Girl are you? Well, I think I was a bit too The phrase that my mum would use all the time was too clever for his own good. This one. So I used to get myself into trouble. It was probably me starting it most of the time with my sister. You know, she'd be listening to this thing going, ah, finally. So that's probably right. And then I suppose I mellowed, really. But, yeah, it's funny. At school, you know, and this is something I've never really told anybody, it was quite different because I went from this little market town, Selby, off to this big city, Leeds, that I was scared stiff of, in truth. You know, I was out of my depth. And it's because I was brought up a Catholic. And so if you passed the 11 plus at the time, the Catholic grammar school was in Leeds. And so that's where you went on a train. And so in this school, there was about 600-700 kids, but only 3-4 of us were from Selby. So we were real outsiders, you know, so we were always, you know, picked on, you know, and I got bullied quite a bit. I remember there was times when I was scared to go to school, cry my eyes out, you know, my mum had to force me to get on the train, you know. So in the house, I suppose I was quite confident, you know, and I was playing that role, but it was quite different at school, really.
That can be a harder thing for boys to admit, can't it, I think, sometimes?
Yeah, I think that might be right. I think there was an element of... And it was my mum was the one who really sort of got the brunt of all this, because I guess my dad was at work, but, you know, it's just like, you know, come on, pull yourself together sort of thing. You know, not in a nasty way, but it's like, come on, you've got to go to school, you know, just get on with it, you know. And I just suppose my mum knew what to do. You know, school was a long way away. She wasn't on the doorstep. So, yeah, it was one of those, really, where it's just like... And in Yorkshire as well, you know, up north, it's very much that, you know, come on, you know. It's like, boys don't cry when they're 14. Don't be ridiculous. Get on with it, you know. So,
I'm interested in your love of dogs and when it started.
We didn't really talk about dogs an awful lot in the family, I suppose. It's just one of those subjects. It's like that's what other people do, you know. Where it came from was, for me, was, you know, so after I left home growing up, found myself with a girlfriend who got a dog, you know. So
but there were dogs in your neighborhood, because I've read your book.
Yeah, there was a little poodle called Pepe, and he was an apricot colored dog, and he lived across the way. So we lived in an estate that had been built in the 60s on the edge of town, sort of thing. And just the other side of the cul-de-sac, in this other bungalow, was a very glamorous girl called Gillian. I wonder where she is now. And she was a bit older than me. He was dead cute, and he was a really nice dog. And the one abiding memories, I know where he's buried. I could go back now and point to the particular patch in their garden, because I remember one day... They were digging this hole, and out came this plastic bag, and the plastic bag went in the hole. What are you doing? Oh, that's Pepe. He's died, and we're burying him. Because that's what you did in those days. There was no pack cremation service, you know. So, yeah, I could take you back to that street in Selby and go to the current owners. Your front garden.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that's where Pepe is, bless him. Yeah, so it was from one poodle to another, because then sort of by the time I'd, you know, I'd met this girlfriend and a poodle called Noodle, who'd been named by the 6-year-old daughter. I mean, I've got to say, as a name goes for a 6-year-old, I think that's a cracking name to come up with. I'd have been proud of that one myself.
When did you first realise that you had, I suppose, an affinity with and for dogs, that you were able to sort of communicate with dogs in a way that perhaps, you know, other people don't sort of lack the confidence to communicate with dogs in the way that you do? So when did you realise that you got dogs?
Well, it's a funny old thing, because it's a creeping one, that. There was no, you know, it'd be great if I could tell you there was some dramatic moment when, you know, that was the moment when I realised. And it wasn't quite like that with, certainly with Noodle. It's just that, you know, we'd cuddle up together. Oh, this is what dogs like, is it? Yeah, fair enough. And then now and again, he might do something naughty. Yeah, but at Noodle, you know, and he'd be like, oh, okay. But, and we got on really well. I thought, this is quite good, you know. And people would say, you've got quite a way with that dog, haven't you? Well, yeah, I suppose I have, really.
But you weren't doing anything, you weren't working with animals, were you? Because you'd gone into sort of management for Weetabix.
That's right. So I'd left uni and I'd studied Spanish, well, Hispanic studies, actually, and then gone into, as you say, so Weetabix Limited. So I was a graduate trainee initially, and basically on the production side, so managing the factories. And that was it, literally 21 years there, working my way up. So by the time I left, I suppose, quite a senior place, really, a team of a couple of hundred people. So what I didn't realise then was that I was learning, mainly by making mistakes, how to be a leader of people, you know. And it's not, obviously, it's not about, it shouldn't be about being bossy and shouting and screaming and forcing people to do things. It's about getting people to willingly come with you, you know. And there are lots of similarities with that, and dogs, of course. And sometimes it's the tone, you know. So if you stand in front of a group of people in the canteen at 2 a.m, because you're doing the rounds of all the different shifts because there's a big change coming and you've got something to announce, and you look unsure of yourself, and you're umming and ahhing and all the rest of it, people start to think he's talking rubbish here. This is nonsense. We're not going to go for this. You know, you're in big trouble. Yeah, I mean, I suppose I learned an awful lot. But there was a bit of a us and them thing going on with, you know, management and shop floor, which I always found difficult to sort of cope with, you know. And you're kind of just automatically one of them when you were one of the bosses. And you imagine, can't you, walking in as the graduate trainee. It's like, who does he think he is? But I've actually discovered since I left that people who work with me back then have got in touch since, say lovely things about, you know, I was a nice person to work with, it turns out. Do you know what I think is important when it comes to leadership? It's this, we all have this, there's loads of adages, isn't there, about things like, oh, you know, we like that person because she's, let's say, you know, firm but fair. There's a phrase that you hear all the time. Well, that works with dogs. So what I often say to people, if I'm trying to paint a picture of the way you need to be with the dog, it's like, think about the best boss you've ever worked with, right? And if you've got an image of that person, you're probably thinking about somebody who didn't scream and shout to get things done because they never needed to go that far. They were really clear in the way that they communicated, so you knew where you stood, right? So you would say about people like that, for example, cool, I wouldn't want to get the wrong side of her. But actually, nobody's ever seen what the wrong side looks like because nobody ever needs to go there. And one of the things that I'm always saying with dogs is that, you know, when you do get something right, not necessarily all the time, but they'll drip in the odd bit of like, oh, well done. And the ones that are really good at it aren't just praising all the time, because then it loses its effect, doesn't it?
Take me back to when you first decided to get a dog, because it feels like you left Weetabix and kind of in the same, you know, era, you also had two dogs of your own suddenly.
About the time that I left Weetabix, I'd got these two dogs. So one came after the other. So there was Axel. So Rottweiler, got him from a breeder, all of that stuff. And then a few months later, along came Gordon, and it was about 9 months later. There was 9 months between them. Gordon the Rottweiler. I quite like that juxtaposition between this supposedly great big rough and tough dog and his name's like Gordon, you know.
You'd never had a dog in your life, and I'm thinking you're around 40 at this time when you got these two Rottweilers. To me, that is like passing your driving test at 40 and just saying, I'll have two Formula One cars, please.
Well, I did previous to that, many moons previous, I'd passed a motorbike test and went out and bought a Kawasaki GPZ 900R. So yeah.
Well, now we're getting to the heart of Graham here.
You just, yeah. So we moved on from living with a girl with a poodle, and then I married someone who got a Rottweiler, actually. So so when we first met, she's like, yeah, come back to mine. Are you okay with dogs? I went, yeah, dogs, fine, like dogs. But she didn't tell me that this was a Rottweiler. So I walked in, Hooch was the daftest dog in the world. So I walked in, I'm 6'2", and he went, hello. And his paws were on my shoulders. I'm like, oh, my God. So hello, you're nice, I think. He was just the... He was a great big lump of a dog, but he was lovely. And lived with him for quite a while. He died, he was 13 years old when he died, and that's really old for a Rottie. And if you ever look back at pictures of him at that time, he really looked like the dog version of a very, very frail old man, you know. But he had a bit about him. I mean, I was I was fixing a fence at a back garden where I lived once, and the ground was very uneven. I stepped backwards, didn't realise I'd stepped on his paw because of the where the ground was, and put my full weight on it. He didn't bark or anything. All I felt was this whacking great clamping force on me on me calf, which was his way of going, get off, you fool. My wife at the time was an A&E nurse. I had been an A&E nurse. So long story short, she said, there's two ways to do this. One involves a four-hour queue at A&E, and the other involves me getting some kit from upstairs. That's the good news. The bad news is there's no local anaesthetic to be had. What do you want to do? So she stitched me up there, and then...
I'm starting to feel that's what I'd call quite a Graham thing to happen, because you talk about your childhood in this slight Yorkshire attitude of keep calm and carry on. It'll all work out all right. You just have to keep going.
It'll be right. Yeah, I think you're right. Actually, that's probably quite a Yorkshire thing, isn't it? It's like, it'll be right. You know, it'll be, You know, and actually that sounds like me dad now, just saying I can hear my dad in the voice there. You know, yeah, come on, it'll be right. I mean, that example there was just pragmatic, really. And it wasn't in a big, tough, like, oh, aunt, look at me, you know. It was, although I have died out on it since, but it really was just like, do I really want to go down Northampton General for 4 hours or whatever? Or, come on, just, yeah, it's going to hurt, but just, yeah, it's going to hurt for 3 minutes, isn't it? So let's get on with it, you know. And then I went out the back garden and it was a bit stiff, but I finished the fence and the neighbours thought I was mad.
So Axel and Gordon, that you really loved those dogs, didn't you? They became a huge part of your life, and they kind of, in one way or another, led to you becoming the best dog trainer in the country.
So Hooch was the previous Rottie who'd bit me. I knew nothing about dogs then, you know. And what happened was, so he died, and 3 weeks later we were broken into. And at the time, my wife said, "Look, you know, once he's gone, he's gone. He was lovely, but I've lived with dogs for a long time. So, and of course, that was my first experience of losing a dog dying. You know, but once he's gone, he's gone. And I'm going to get a white sofa because you can't have a white sofa when there's a Rottie in the house. So that was that. 3 weeks later, we were broken into, and we lost a couple of bits that were very sentimental. And I said, no, that's it. Come on, let's get another dog. Because if there'd have been a dog in the house, he didn't need to do anything nasty. And I certainly didn't want to get a dog to train as an attack dog, you know. But just a dog barking. And if you ever hear a Rottweiler bark in a house, you wouldn't go there, you know. And that was sort of it. So I started looking around. I think it was just an excuse because really, really, I wanted another dog, you know. So we got Axel. And it was love at first sight. I realised the publication date was coming up, and in my case, that was the 18th of Feb. And I thought that, I couldn't put my finger on it, but that date just really rang a bell. 18th of Feb, 15 years previously, exactly to the day was when we brought Axel back, so from the breeder. So getting Axel, if you'd have said to me then, you know, what do you think the chances are that in 15 years' time you'll have written a book, you'll have been on the telly, people will be saying, you know, you're one of the, you know, the most well-known dog trainers in the country and all that kind of thing. I said, there's no chance. So I got Axel, and already it's like, okay, so at the time, the devil dog in the press was a Rottweiler, and they would roll out. There was a standard stock pick of a Rottweiler bearing teeth that often would get dragged out when there'd been some sort of dog attack, sadly, somewhere in the country. And often that would be a different breed of dog. But it was just the one dog that they wanted to vilify. You know? So I thought, right, he's got to be bang on. So I'm going to really throw myself into dog training. And one of my things, and it came from a grandfather that I never knew. He died just before I was born. I grew up with the shadow of this man, you know. It's like, oh, he's just like his grandfather. And one thing that apparently he used to say all the time, it was my mum's dad, was if a job's worth doing, it's worth doing well, you know. And, of course, everybody says that all around the country, but said in a Yorkshire way, it just has this quite right to it, you know. So all right, I'll throw myself into dog training if a job's worth doing. So I really did. I mean, I got the books, I learned everything, as everybody does. Went to a dog training club across in Birmingham, actually. So I used to travel there every weekend, and then started sort of volunteering there, helping out the head trainer. And that's, it sort of went from there. So by the time I got Gordon, I was sort of already beginning to do that, because I'd seen these guys coming in, and they're almost always men, actually, or they were then. And I learned how much they were making a day, and I'm like, well, you know, the stuff that you're talking about is kind of common sense to me. So if you can do it, so can I.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ricky Gervais, who came on this podcast, he always says there's no such thing as bad dogs, just bad people. What do you think about that?
Well, no, I mean, yes and no, right? So I think it was probably Barbara Woodhouse who first coined that. And that's because back in those days, we're talking 70s, 80s again now, and for those who don't know, Barbara Woodhouse was like the first TV dog trainer.
She used to wear a kilt and say, walkies.
She did, yeah. Well, yeah, actually, a lot of what she wore was tweed. I mean, who would ever have imagined a dog trainer wearing tweed on the telly? It's ridiculous. So, add a cravat, what have you got? So, the thing at the time really was, if a dog's misbehaving, it's obviously the dog's fault. The dog needs to be punished. It's a bad dog. And so she was the first one that coined this phrase. And it really stuck. No such thing as a bad dog, only bad owners. Now, I think the truth is somewhere between those two extremes, because I often go to houses and I'm looking at people going, you're not bad people. You're actually very reasonable people. But boy, have you got yourselves a problem here and you don't know what to do. So, and often people are saying, well, we know we've got this spectacularly wrong. We just don't know what to do. Please help. Just show us how. So you wouldn't really say they're bad owners, are they? But equally, that's probably not a bad dog. He's just been, you know, he's a product of his upbringing, isn't he? So yeah, I think it's interesting. And also, just like humans, I mean, we've been talking about my background, which is really interesting, because when you talk through in some depth with somebody like this, you begin to realise a bit about yourself, don't you, where you come from. We're all a product of our genes and the things that we've learnt in life. So it's the age-old thing about nature and nurture, and that's exactly the same with a dog. So some of it's genetic and a lot of it is what you learn.
You present dogs behaving very badly on Channel 5, which I'm such a huge fan of this show. My dog Raymond, sometimes he can be, he'll just literally get up and walk away if the TV's on. He'll only watch David Attenborough and Graham Hall. He likes your voice, Graham. I think he
Does
finds
he?
Your
That's
voice soothing.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a nice thing. Well, I'd say that was a compliment. It's funny, though. You're right. Dogs, they either get the telly or they don't. And Axel and Gordon were interesting, because Axel, in his whole life, I don't think I ever saw him sit and watch the telly. He'd be in the room with you more often than not, facing away from the telly. He just didn't get that it was there. Gordon, though, would watch the telly. He didn't react badly to it. He would just
Of course
sit
he did.
Watch.
He's called Gordon. He's basically
yeah,
a Gordon. Man.
That's right. Axel thought he was above it, didn't he? But when I first came on the telly, the very first show we ever did, right? So you can imagine, he's like, oh, we're going to be on the telly tonight. So we're all sat there watching, you know, and Gordon was there with me, right? And you could see, he's like, hang on a minute, right? And then he looked at me, and he looked back at the telly, and he walked out the room. He's just like, this is too weird.
It's a fascinating show, because often what you're doing, you're part therapist with the owners, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. The guy who was the head trainer at that club that I used to go to in Birmingham when I learned lots of this stuff, I remember him saying, "You're quite good with people as well as dogs, and I think you should, you know, you should make this your profession." But the reason he said that, he said, was that you can only fix the dogs through the people. And of course, he was right, because it's no good just going out, showing off, doing magic stuff with the dog. The dog goes, "Oh, yeah, yeah, I'll do anything for you. Yeah, great. Yeah, like, see, nothing wrong with your dog. See you then." That's not going to help anyone. So you've got to do that bit. So the show really kind of shows that, you know. So I go in, sit down, listen to what they've got to tell me. I'm like, okay, well, I better see this problem then, you know. And then it's a case of, right, okay, understand what's going on. So the first question in my mind is, okay, what's going on in this dog's head? Why is he doing this? And how can I turn that around? And then I'll give it a go myself. And then if that's working, it's a case of, right, okay, you have a go. And often that bit's the hardest. And the one thing is that we don't pay attention to our tone of voice, right? So we're obsessed with the words we use, because that's the kind of animals we are, but we don't often listen to the sound, right? So you can say no in all sorts of different ways. So I had a client the other day who sent me a video. So this was a private client I'd seen a couple of years ago, moved house, new problem, long story short, sent me a little video of something the dog's doing. And said, "Yeah, any chance you can have a look at this and just let me know where I might be going wrong." And it was her voice. So to start with, it was like, no. And then it didn't appear to be working. So straight away, if you listen to this, and it's the sound that counts here, it's like, no. It's like, "I don't believe you." Don't believe you. It's like, this is never going to work. So it's... You know, it's not all about telling dogs off, but it's the same with praise, right? So if you think about praise, then there's an excited version or a calm version, right? By which I mean, so your voice could be, you know, "Oh, good boy, Ray."
So let me try it now. I've got Ray here. No. No, Ray, no.
It's the Ray bit that gets me. No, Ray. You've been a very naughty, but you're only a bit far away from learning. So that's where it started to go a bit wrong. It wasn't horrible. I've heard a lot worse.
So I need to ditch the Ray.
Well, here's the thing. You know the thing where if you've got a long version of your name, right? So do people call you Em as well as Emily?
I love Em.
There you go. So I don't know if it was the case with you, but quite often it will be. If you call Em all the time, right? It's when somebody goes, "Emily." It's like, I'm in trouble now, right? So you can use that trick with the dog. They don't recognise the fact this is the long version of the show. It's the sound, right? Because if you use Ray for the noise stuff and you went, "Raymond," it's the sound. Listen to that. Dum, dum, right? "Raymond, no." It's like the beat of a kettle drum. It's like, dum, end of.
What I like, Graham, is that I am learning about myself, because I think if I have to tell someone something difficult in an email, I'll always put sort of qualifiers around it. And I think me saying, "No, Ray, is the same as me saying, "Just thought I'd drop you a quick note." Yes. To say, "Can you stop playing thrash metal at 4 a.m?
If you wouldn't mind awfully.
If you could bear it in mind.
Yes.
I'd be so grateful. Do you think that's the same thing in a way as me
it
saying,
is a bit.
"No, Ray.
Yes, we do that quite a lot. I'll tell you another one, a classic that we do, and moving away from sort of tone of voice, but actually contradicting myself now, because these are a couple of words I'm going to say that we often use when we shouldn't, right? So spot what's wrong with this. If you say to a dog, "Come on, be a good boy," you're saying that while he's being naughty, aren't you? Right? But you're saying, "Da, da, da, good boy." So he's hearing a load of blah, blah, blah words he doesn't really get. But "good boy," he's like, "Oh, I know those two words." So he's like... So I'm crapping on the carpet and you're going, "Being a good boy." "Good boy, you like it when I crap on the carpet." "Oh, well, your wish is my command." And that's dogs for you. The other thing about dogs is they're so literal. Right? It's just like, no, yes, thank you very much. You didn't need to explain it in 1,000 words with a dissertation. Thanks. It's just like, don't do that. Do this. Thank you. That, to me, that's the joy of dogs, really. Yeah.
And you've said as well, both in your book and you say this on the show, excitement often is the root of the problem, isn't it? Overexcitement.
It's quite an unusual one, this, for a British dog trainer in particular, I think, to be saying, because the traditional way of doing things around here has been the whoopee-doo stuff, you know, it's like, yeah, woo, you know. And if you go to any puppy class in the land, it's all of that. And don't get me wrong, there is a place for that. So the people saying that, they're not wrong. It's just too much excitement at the wrong time is what gets you into trouble, right? It's very rare that anybody's ever called. I think it's happened once in 5,000 dogs where somebody called and said, can you send Graham out in a hurry because my dog's too calm? That's super rare. Mainly, he's barking too much. He's got separation anxiety, which is a kind of excitement, isn't it? He's running around, won't come back. He pulls on the lead. It's all different flavours of too much excitement. So if you use praise in too excited a way in those moments, so let's say you've got a dog who's barking for whatever reason, doesn't matter for the time being, he's just barking, right? And then he stops, and we think, ah, great, he stopped, he's quiet, therefore I must now praise him for being quiet. Yes, that's correct. But if you do it in an excited way, oh, good boy, he's like, pop, and he's back up again, because you've just revved him back up. So excitement's usually the core of the problem, and if you praise them for them being good, and you do that in an excited way, you've messed it up. So I'm almost obsessed with, can I hear excitement in that voice or calmness? And does that match what we're trying to do here, you know? The opposite's also true, right? So if you're trying to do, I'll give you a great example of this. Recall, getting a dog to run back to you. So that's about excitement. You want excitement for that one. So your call needs to be nice and bright and happy. So a bit sort of like, you know, Fido, come, you know, that kind of thing. Because if you stand there and go, as many men do, right, Fido, come here, right? Fido's like, I don't know about that. You sound a bit upset, you know. That's where you need excitement. So when we did a celebrity special for dogs behaving very badly, and Denise Van Outen was on it, of course, she's an actor, so she knows how to project a voice and all the rest of it. So her partner, she was explaining to Eddie how to do this, right? And then she didn't actually do what she told him. She sort of lightened everything up. And I'm like, hello, listen to yourself. And I think we do that. You know, we go all daft when there's a dog around, you know.
You did. Just... You had Michael Owen on that series, and he had a staffie, I think, didn't he?
Mm-hmm. He did. So the problem that Michael had, and we had some CCTV footage of it, is that somebody had been walking past the entrance of his house and his dog had run out and actually bitten the other dog, which was very out of character because he was such a sweet dog. He was lovely. However, yeah, that's obviously a big deal. Now, the man was lovely about it, apparently, and it was all sorted out very amicably. But Michael was a really responsible dog owner. And a bit like when I first got Rotties, he's like, look, he's a staffie, you know, people rightly or wrongly have a perception about them. And, well, wrongly, frankly, you know, so if he scares somebody or whatever, it's going to be a big deal. And, you know, Michael Owen's famous. So the dog's got to be just right. And what was happening there was that every time there was somebody walking along the footpath, which was sort of bordered his property, Michael was starting to tense up. You could see it, you know. So he was beginning to go, oh, no, here we go. And it was in his voice and everything. And, of course, the dog's like, okay, so there's some people down there. You've gone from your normal calm self to on edge. There's a problem, isn't there?
You didn't say calm down, calm down.
Calm down. I should have done, shouldn't I? Calm down, lad.
You should have just turned up and said, look, Michael, calm down, calm down.
Yeah,
okay, yeah,
calm
if
down,
you could
lad.
Just put the money in my account. That's not... Has ever been a case where you've thought, I think this person possibly is not the right temperament to be a dog owner?
Yeah, that happens. You know, I've been into houses where, you know, it's you know, there's a man and a wife and the dog just does not get on with the man. And I'm looking at the man thinking, I don't particularly like you, myself. I can't exactly blame the dog. You know, there is, I think, still in our country, this blokey thing of dogs must obey. You know, I am the master. You will just, you know, and I'm not going to put any effort in, because usually the girls who end up taking the dogs to the training classes, you know, and then the guy benefits from that. But on the odd occasion the dog doesn't obey, then it's an affront to his masculinity. You know, you've got to earn the right to be the leader, haven't you? You know, and again, I go back to that sort of human leadership thing. You know, shouting and screaming and bullying isn't the way to go. Frankly, I suppose it will get you so far. It's not the right way to do it, but that's not where you want to be. And things like rules, like the dog must never be on the sofa, dog mustn't be on the bed. Another one that's very common is you must always go through a door first to show a moves boss. So where those things come from is, yeah, if you get a dog, and again, there was one on the show very recently where a youngish Wiesler actually was called Ruger. He was on the back of a sofa looking down on mum and dad, you know, and it was just leading to this, like, this dog can do anything he wants, wherever he wants, he can sit where he wants, you know, there are no boundaries. So in that case, it was, yeah, let's get him off the sofa, that's going to send a signal. But it may well be, if you said to me, well, me and Ray, we sit on the settee and we watch the telly and it's just lovely and really nice, I'd be the last person to say that dog must be off the sofa, because you haven't got a problem.
I want to talk about something a bit sad, because it isn't, I think this will be really helpful to people listening, Graham, because you write in your book, really movingly actually, about when you lost your dog, Axel, and then Gordon not that long after.
That's right. A couple of things I'd learned from other people was there are perhaps good ways of letting go, and one thing that I'd learned over the years is, if it's possible to get the vet to come to you, if you know it's going to happen and perhaps today's the day, then that's nicer for the dog, because they're in their own environment. They're, you know, in the case of Axel and Gordon, I can still see it now, you know, in the kitchen, lying on the floor where they've just spent so much time, you know, and they fall asleep, you know, and it's sad for everyone, but it's easier for them. So that was a lesson, and I really wanted to get that across. And the other thing was, if you've got two dogs, I'd seen so many cases over the years of people saying, we lost a dog, and then the remaining one spent so much time scrabbling at the door, looking out the window, just couldn't understand that the other one went to the vets one day and never came back, you know. And there's no science behind this particular one that I'm aware of, but it just seems that they get it if they see the body afterwards, you know, briefly. So if it happens at home, again, it's easier to do that. So with Axel, the hardest thing about Axel was making the call to the vet. excuse me. Even now, I think you can tell it affects me. And I remember picking up the phone and saying, can you please send Hugo? And I couldn't say the rest of the words. And the lady knew what it was and said, I think you want me to send him for Axel. Yeah, yes, please. But we put Gordon out the room. And Axel went, and he was lying there. The vet I'd known for a long time, he was a nice guy, brought Gordon in. Gordon was, well, kind of hilarious. So he came in, had one sniff at Axel, kind of went, oh, you're dead there. Oh, well. Ah, vet, hello, let's play. Like, blimey, Gordon. So, and then he did go through a bit of a grieving process, which is typical of dogs. They, you know, they often are a bit subdued, like the rest of us, you know. And I think there is no speeding up of that process. You've just got to go through it, and it takes us all, you know, different amounts of time, and you know, the old sort of classic thing about grieving, you know, the anger and disbelief and all that stuff, it happens at different times, and I don't think there's any set thing. That's what I've learned. But that was that with Axel. And Gordon then, a surprising thing I suppose happened with Gordon, that over the next few months, and he was already an old dog, he was out from under the shadow of Axel. Axel was very much the boss of the two of them, you know. So once Axel was gone, Gordon was like, right, so I can run around the back garden and make a complete fool of myself and nobody's going to give me the evil eye, you know. And I didn't realise quite how much effect Axel had had on him, I think. So he bounced around like Bambi, and there'd been an element of that right through his life. He was always a cheeky chap, was Gordon. And then one day, just a few months after Axel had gone, really, I sort of noticed that he wasn't bouncing around like Bambi anymore. He just wasn't, you know. So I thought, that's a bit odd. Nothing you could put your finger on. So I took him into the vets and said, let's check him out. Turned out he had tumours in lots of different sites, including, we thought, in his brain. So it was a case of, right, we need to think about, okay, so do we prolong his life, you know, get him on the right kind of chemo and all the rest of it? And that was likely to prolong it by about a month, you know, Hugo thought. So, but, you know, you ask the questions like, actually, who am I doing this for? You know, am I doing it for Gordon or am I doing it for me? Because I just don't want to, you know, say goodbye. And he comes to the conclusion in the end that I can't give him a month of bouncing Bambi anymore, can I? I can't give him a month of being 2 years old running through the fields. I'm just going to keep him going because, you know, to avoid the obvious. So in the end, palliative care was a surprisingly easy decision to make. Let's just keep him pain-free and then, you know, it'll happen, won't it? But it was incredibly quick. That trip to the vets, I think, was on a Thursday. And over the weekend, he deteriorated. And he suddenly couldn't walk very well. He was bumping into things. And it was on the Tuesday that we said goodbye. So, yeah. And about the same time, my dad died. So, yeah, hard time that was.
I'm so sad for you because, that's, by the way, I'm crying. We're all crying. Ray's crying.
It was really interesting with Gordon. He understood what had happened to Axel, like, in a second. I mean, I was amazed. He literally looked, sniffed and went, yeah, right. And that was that, you know. And he never once did the looking out the window or anything like that. He was just flat for quite a while, you know. So, of course, then it was a case of, right, should we get another dog, you know. But it was a while. It was a few months, actually. So I was a dog father without a dog for a little while because it was just too soon. You know.
I totally understand that. And you've had Lily in your life recently, haven't you, as well, who's a lovely Labrador?
Yeah, Labrador cross boxer. So I always describe her as half Labrador and half bonkers. She's...
People have said that about me, to be honest.
Well, there's worse things to be called. But yeah, I mean, she was lovely. So she was a rescue dog. So I'd done the puppy thing, and then I thought, right, now let's get a rescue dog. So for a couple of reasons, one, I'll be really honest, was just a practical reason. It's just like I'm not around enough to have a little puppy and go through all the puppy things, and I think people sometimes underestimate how much effort that is. You know, Labradors are a pretty good bet, actually. I don't really want a case of my own when I come home at night. Right? People imagine I would take on a really badly behaved dog and turn around. And it's not that I can't. It's just that when you've done it all day long, you just want to come home and cuddle your dog, don't you?
When you've been out with Lily, have you felt that it's a bit like Super Nanny being out with her own kids, I think, in that she must feel very self-conscious. If her child has a tantrum or says, no, to go to McDonald's, you think, oh no, my brand's in trouble now, please behave.
To some extent it was ever thus, and if you think about where I came from with the Rotties, it's like these dogs have got to be perfect because they're Rottweilers. Then it became, I'm the bloke with the two Rottweilers who's now a dog trainer. Who do you think he is? Yeah, those dogs have got to be brilliant. So, and then yeah, suddenly, you know, I got this dog who pulled like you wouldn't believe. I mean, she was a lovely dog, great temperament, bonkers, absolutely mad. So a friend texted me and said, you got that? Yeah. Does she pull? Because I'd said, you know, apparently she pulls a bit. Does she pull? I said, does she pull? She's heading up the 8:15 to Euston tomorrow morning. So I'm walking this thing. He was pulling me arm. I'm like, Lily, we got, you know. So that took a bit of a bit of training. But there's nothing like it. I mean, she's so excited to see. If I've been away for a while, I come back. Saturday morning, for example, I walked in and she hadn't seen me for a little while. And it's just like bouncy, bouncy. It's like spinning on the spot. Box runners will recognise this. They spin on the spot like you wouldn't believe. It looks as though they're trying to chase the tail, but it's not that. And it's just like spin, 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 spin. And then she's like jumped at me. You know, and then went, spin, 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 and then jumped at me. And I thought, yeah, if the cameras were on now, it'd be like, look at him, can't control his own dog. But she literally couldn't control herself. Well, that's a nice thing, isn't it?
How do you cope with fame or being recognised, Graham? Is it something you're comfortable with?
Yeah, I am, actually. People are invariably lovely, you know, I find. So... okay. I mean, the first time was a bit weird. And I was at a petrol pumps near where I live, and I was putting some fuel in the car. Because the thing is with me as well, that car is recognised everywhere. You know, the big white Land Rover Discovery with this dog number plate, you know. And even though the first bit's fuzzed out on the telly, people just spot it. So, but the first time, there I am, putting fuel in, minding my own business, and all I can hear from behind is, dog folder! I'm like, what the heck's that? And it was a load of builders in a white van who then went circling round all the pumps twice, going, dog folder, white mate!
Are people friends and strangers a lot of the time? Do they approach you and ask you advice? Is that always people's opening gambit?
Often. And, you know, I think you just got to... I think you'd be a bit up yourself, really, if you sort of went, no, I couldn't possibly only do that on the television, dear, you know. So I always think, well, you know, fair enough, if I can help a bit. There's always a caveat, which is, look, without seeing your dog and spending a bit of time understanding it, there's a limit to what I can say, but, you know, try me. So you get that.
I think people who end up performing or play having some sort of public role, I think they tend to be extroverts as kids. I think they tend to have what I call the look at me gene. I think there's a performer in you, isn't there, that was sort of dying to come out, I feel.
I think that's right. I mean, I remember as a kid, and it's the sort of thing that, again, it's a cultural thing in our country. You know, it's like don't admit that you like showing off, because that's not a dumb thing. We're British, you know. But yeah, I was like that. I was as a kid. It's like, hey, look, yeah, it is literally the look at me gene. Yeah, it's brilliant that. It was like, hey, I've done this thing at school, so I'm going to let me show you, you know. So, there was that there. I recognise that. So you would be in trouble, I think, if you got into this world and then really didn't want to talk to people when they bumped into you in the street. Do you know what I mean? I think you've... You know, I like talking to people, I always have. And I say people are invariably nice, so it's like, you know.
I can't imagine you, Graham, losing your temper or shouting at anyone, really. You seem quite calm.
Yeah, I mean, we've all got another side, haven't we? But I am pretty much on a level most of the time, but I do get quite passionate about certain things, you know, so...
What do you get passionate about?
Well, I'm not really a massively political sort of person, for example, but I see certain things that happen that I just think are outrageously wrong, like people going to Barnard Castle when they shouldn't be and things like that.
If we're flatmates, let's say, I don't know, let's say you're upset because I haven't loaded the dishwasher and I'm your flatmate. How do you express that anger at me?
Yeah, you see, I think I am, I suppose I've been accused of being blunt before. Because it is just that Yorkshire, I'll just sort of say it, I think.
What would you say?
What would I say? I'd be like, am I the only one around here whoever does that bloody, you know, dishwasher, you know, something like that, you know. Yeah, I don't mince words when it comes to things like that.
Well, you know, people often say about, you know, it's like I tell it like it is that Yorkshire thing.
Yeah, I think that is true. I don't think it is one of those cliches that's sort of made up. I think it just is that's the case. The other thing about Yorkshire is, and when you're talking about that sort of thing, B words mean nothing in Yorkshire. Bloody bugger. It's just like all it is. It's just, it's almost polite conversation. So, and that adjusts, you have to adjust a bit when you come down south. So you see, in the house, I'd be like, bloody dishwasher again. You know, that's just the way I'd talk.
How someone comes across is to do with your capacity for tolerating it, really, isn't it? Because it's like with my dog, Raymond, or Ray Ray, he's very small, Ray Ray, and so he gets very frightened when we're on walks sometimes. If he sees bigger dogs, I see his body language, he stiffens, he tenses up. And to me, that feels reasonable, because in the same way that if I'm 5'2", so if Kylie Minogue came charging towards me and said, hey, do you want to have a wrestle? I'd say, yeah, why not? Do you know what I mean, though? But if Arnold Schwarzenegger did that, if he said, we will wrestle, I would behave like Ray. I'd say, no, this is dangerous.
Well, it is. I'm chuckling to myself because I'm just trying to work out exactly how I would react if Kylie Minogue came running up to me in a park and went, Graham, do you want to wrestle? I'm like, well, let me think about that. It probably would be quite different to Arnie, in fairness. But dogs and humans aren't the same in that respect. I spend a lot of time pointing out similarities between dogs and humans, right? We've done it all of this conversation, really. But here's one of the big differences, actually. Dogs aren't as bothered about size as us, because I think we've all seen they don't necessarily sort of go, I'm small, you're big, therefore I'm scared. There can be a bit of that from a learnt behaviour, if they got splatted by a big dog by accident. And if Ray's sort of natural tendency is to be a little bit nervous outside or whatever. I tell you what's interesting, though. If you get a dog, your case is interesting, because sometimes what I see is somebody gets a dog when they're very much in a grieving process or not in a good place themselves as a kind of fix it, right? And that dog, so let's say you live on your own, so the dog is looking at you for everything all the time, and you're actually not looking your best self, you know, you're very upset most of the time. The dog starts to sort of reflect that, you know. And that can be, for example, and actually I think there's an episode of the show coming up like this, where you've lost a dog and it's the dog that you're grieving for, and you get another one straight away, and it's maybe a wee bit too soon, you know. So, or you're just naturally a person who is, you know, just a bit anxious outside, you know. So if you're walking along thinking, not sure about that fella walking towards us, you know, if on the outside you can give off this sort of like, yeah, it's a guy, it's fine, you know. Ray's like, mum, I don't like this. It's like, yeah, it'd be right, you know.
Okay, so what I'll stop doing is picking him up saying, Ray, get away from my dog.
That's the one.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to mention your podcast, Talking Dogs with Graham Hall, because it's so brilliant. It's sort of similar to the show in podcast form, essentially, isn't it? You take topics every show, but you also deal with specific listeners sending in problems they're having.
The show on the telly is great and entertaining, but we're only scratching the surface, really. You haven't got the time on the telly to explain why you're doing what you're doing very much, just the very basic details. Whereas in a half an hour's worth of chat on a podcast, you can go into a bit more of the psychology behind it, all that kind of thing. But also it meant that people were contacting me through the various social channels and going, can I ask you this question? And then we, you know, I'd be going, ah, that's brilliant. Could you put that in a voice note so that we can have it on the podcast and I'll answer it there? Because lots of people would want to hear the answer to that. We often will split them down. So instead of, let's say, doing a podcast on dogs being aggressive, let's talk about dogs being aggressive because they're nervous, or a dog being aggressive for, you know, whatever, a different reason, you know. So often people will email us in. Sometimes I just read out the email, but it's always great if you can hear somebody's voice. And not least of which, because they've got different accents, which I love accents, and I love travelling around the country. And I just think it gives the podcast a bit of colour, you know. So we had one recently, and I'm not above having a bit of fun with people. There's a lady sent a voicemail in, and she was from Hull. And she said, I've got this problem with my dog, and he's doing this, that, and the other, and I've tried everything. And I've tried saying no, right? Even that don't work, just like you do on telly. Right, Sue. Well, the first thing is, you're from Hull. I can tell straight away from that accent. Now, for those of you who don't know Hull, in Hull people say things like, oh, no, there's snow on the road, right? Oh, no, there's snow on the road. So the first thing that you're doing wrong, Sue, is you say you've tried saying no. Well, just try saying no, like the rest of us. All jokes apart, I'll answer your question. And so you can have a bit of fun, you know. So the people, I love it when people are asking genuine questions, because instead of me just rattling on, imagining what people might be interested in, well, I might as well answer questions that kind of proves what they're interested in, really.
Mm.
And you learn all the time, you know. There's times when you do something, you think, oh, I got that wrong there. I pushed a wee bit too hard, maybe, or not hard enough. Some people you can be very direct with. It's like, oi, no, you've done it again, haven't you? Right, go on, don't do that.
I like that you're talking to the people like they're the dog. No.
Yeah. I tell you what, get me together with the toddler and I have to really bite my lip, because I'm inclined to go, ah, no. You know, I've got a grandson now and he's 3, 4.
You've got a grandson? Like,
Seth, no.
I didn't even know you had kids.
Ah, well now. So remember Noodle the Poodle? Noodle the Poodle was named by 6-year-old daughter of ex-partner. Yeah. So 6-year-old daughter ain't 6 anymore. She's 30. Just turned 30 very recently.
You in her life. That's so nice.
Yeah. And when we went our separate ways, her mum and I, it was a case of, because we were together for 3-4 years, something like that. We had this moment, by that time she'd started to call me daddy, because I was the only daddy that she'd ever known, actually. And it was like, what do I call you now? And that was one of the most sad things about that breakup. You know, what do I call you now? And I'm like, oh, I don't know, darling. And you can still call me daddy if you want to, you know. I said, what about pretend dad? I think we'd just moved from daddy to dad, you know. So I'm like, what about pretend dad, you know? And she went, yeah, well, you can be a pretend daughter. So we did this jokey thing for years and years, where and we kind of kept in touch on and off, and then a bit more, I suppose, in the last few years. So I'd be out with this gorgeous 20-something, and people go, oh, hi, is this your... Yeah, this is my pretend daughter.
Oh, no.
And you just look to see the reaction.
I ask everyone who comes on here, and it's totally up to you if you feel comfortable answering this, but I ask people if they've had therapy.
An interesting thing there is that, as you're saying, I'm going to ask you this question, and you know, it's up to you whether you answer it. My brain's already going, I'm going to answer it, whatever it is, because the best way I can. No, I haven't had any therapy. And yeah, it's an interesting thing. I sometimes think it would probably help, and I'm certainly not against it. For years, if you'd have asked me, you'd have got the standard Yorkshire answer of like, therapy, load of nonsense. So, money for old rogues. They take your money and they just talk. Or even worse, you talk, they do nout. But no, I mean, I know people do. I've known people for whom it's been really useful. So, but no, I haven't personally. I mean, I could be all cheesy and tell you, well, the dogs are my therapy, but there is an awful lot in just going out for a walk with a dog. Funny enough, to bring it back to the name of your podcast. But, you know, there's great therapeutic value, let's put it that way, in just getting out in the fresh air with your dog. Yeah.
What's made you sort of feel less critical of it, or inclined to have a snap judgment about it, do you think?
Talking to people, I think, who've done it, you know, and realising that, yeah, actually, I think it is good. I mean, I had a couple of experiences, I suppose, a few years ago, a friend who just went to therapy. And I know these days they do therapy that's very much sort of time-bound. It's like, we're going to do it for this amount of time. But I knew somebody who went for like over a year, and it was just like, you get the impression after all, I think, it's almost as though they're looking for problems here, the therapist, just to keep the money rolling in, you know? Terrible thing to say. And I don't think it's like that anymore. You know, I think it tends to be more focused on, okay, let's get to the bottom of this problem. A bit more like what I do, you might say. Let's look at this problem, understand it, get to the bottom of it, and then work out how to fix this as quickly as we reasonably can, you know? And that kind of therapy makes sense to me.
Mm. And I also ask people when they last cried, but I think you sounded like...
About 15 minutes ago on this podcast, yeah. Yeah, get me thinking about my dogs. And, you know, losing my dad was sad, but he was 90. We were very close, and I wrote the eulogy and stood there in church, and I got through that, you know. And there's obviously been tears over that, but the dogs. Even now, when people ask me to talk about Axel and Gordon and lose them, recording the audiobook, for example. I mean, words that I'd written months beforehand, I went through them the night before. I thought, right, I'm going to get through this. And I said to the sound engineer guy, look, I might struggle a bit, you know. And I did, you know. So, yeah, talking about losing the dog sometimes does it. So yeah, last time I cried, about 15 minutes ago.
I have so loved talking to you, and I really think everyone should read your book, All Dogs, Great and Small. It's kind of, there's a bit about your life and a bit more about how you tick and how you got into this, but it's also, there's some of your kind of greatest hits there from the show, and it's your, now that's what I call dogs.
Yeah, it's a funny one, isn't it? I wanted to write a book that would kind of share with people how I do this, you know, the thinking behind it and all that kind of stuff, but I desperately didn't want it to be some boring training manual, so the way to not do that really was to tell stories, really, you know. And when I meet with people doing a one-to-one consultation, it's quite often, if I think a story is appropriate, I'll go, let me tell you the one about, you know. So that's what I did in the book, really. But funny enough, a lot of things that people say about your book, and I'd love to think it was the same about mine, is that it's the make them laugh, make them cry thing, you know. There's some proper emotion in there, you know. Makes a good book.
Well, I felt, yeah. And as long as you do it in the right place where they're meant to be laughing and crying.
Well, yeah.
You don't want them to be in hysterics at the sad bits.
No, that's true.
I'm really sad that we didn't get to see you, but we're both responsible. And Raymond would love to meet you at some point. I think you'd really like him, Graham, except he's quite stubborn and set in his ways. Is that common with Shih Tzus?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They are. They're lovely little companion dogs, Shih Tzus. But, yeah, they do have that everybody describes it as this sort of slightly regal way about them. You know, there's some history to that, of course. But you say stubborn. You were saying before about he's a bit, I can't remember what the word you said was, but I was thinking kind of haughty and aloof. That's a good word for a Shih Tzu, you know. So they do have that about them, you know. But then, you see, if you love a Shih Tzu, that's why, isn't it? So you don't want a dog who's a pushover all the time. You want a bit of spirit, don't you?
I believe you find the right dog for you, you know. And I think possibly Raymond, if someone approaches him and they're sort of overpouring him and being, if there's over-exuberance in his face, you know what Raymond does, Graham? Mm-hmm. He turns the other cheek and looks skyward.
It's like you're trying too hard, you are.
What's the standout quality, Graham, that humans can learn from dogs?
I always say that nobody ever sent a dog on a mindfulness course. And it's a sort of slightly jerky thing, I think. It's pretty obvious. But the fact is they're really good at here and now. You know, it's like, I've got food, I've got a ball, I've got a bed to lie down on, I'm happy. I'm not going to worry about later on, and I'm not going to worry about the past so much, you know. And I think, you know, we hear it from so many different places, don't we? It's, and at a time when we're in great change, as we have been in the last couple of years, it really helps, I think, to ground yourself in that. Right now, this moment, I'm okay. And there's food in the fridge. I'm all right. Let's not worry about everything else too much. And dogs, I think, are pretty good at that.
There's food in the fridge, Raymond. Oh, no, now he wants food, Graham.
Now you've done it.
Graham, when I need to discipline Ray...
Tell me something naughty that he does, Emily.
When I'm sitting on the sofa, because I've had him up previously, he starts pawing the ottoman and going...
So, first things first, you're from down south, you've got an ottoman, we got a stool. Right, Em, here's what you do, right? So he's pawing at you, right? So what we're going to do is we're going to imagine a scenario where he's pawing at you, right? And then you tell him off, and then he stops pawing, right? And then you're going to praise him for being a good boy, right? And it's going to sound like this. Raymond, no. Oh, good boy, that's nice. See the difference? That's how the tone works. Dead easy. Piece of cake. And don't call it an ottoman. It's a stool.
Well, Graham, I've loved talking to you. Thank you so much. And please, can Ray and I come and meet you at some point?
Well, what we'll do is, when the war's over, we'll go out for that walk properly. So it was lovely to chat, but let's go for a dog walk.
I actually feel so excited at the thought of it. Ray, we're going to meet Graham. I know.
That's nice.
Say goodbye. Ray, can you say goodbye to Graham? Graham, say goodbye to Ray.
There you go. Bye-bye, Ray. Good boy. There you go. I'll tell you what, if he says goodbye, Graham, back, we'll both be on the telly.
I really hope you enjoyed listening to that. And do remember to rate, review and subscribe on iTunes.